Major funding for the following edition of Soundings comes from the Ford Foundation. Additional support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
What I like about Langston Hughes is that he early on decided in his life that he had to do something with it of consequence to a large number of people, not simply of black people, but of all Americans and of the world. If he could do that,
well, rap music is just a logical, natural part of the African American vernacular tradition, and it extended out of the music of the 60s and the 70s, and I find it very exciting, very interesting.
Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. In celebration of Black History Month 1991, Soundings now presents the concluding segment in a series of discussions exploring African-American history and literature. This week, I'll talk with two prominent literary critics, Henry Louis Gates, Jr. of Duke University and Arnold Rampersad of Princeton University. First, a conversation with Henry Louis Gates, Jr. about African-American literary criticism. Following that, you'll hear a conversation with Arnold Rampersad about his biography of Langston Hughes. Henry Louis Gates, Jr. is the author of The Signifying Monkey, A Theory of African-American Literary Criticism, published by Oxford University Press. In 1989, The Signifying Monkey was named a winner of an American Book Award. Henry Louis Gates, Jr. is also the author of Figures in Black, Words, Signs, and the Racial Self. Skip Gates, welcome back to Soundings. What is the Signifying Monkey?
Well, the Signifying Monkey is a character in Afro-American folklore. They're the Signifying Monkey tales, and the tales are hilariously funny, and they include three principal characters, the monkey, the lion, and the elephant. And the plot's always the same, though it has interesting variations, but the fundamental plot is always the same.
Does it have a beginning and a middle and an end? Where does
yes,
it take us?
It's rhyme verse with the plot that has the monkey go to the elephant, who's always asleep, and say, "Wake up, wake up. If you heard what the lion said about you, you'd be really angry." And not only did he say it about you, he said it about your mother and your grandmother and all of the female ancestors in your entire on your entire family tree.
I hear two live crew in the background.
Absolutely. So the elephant, of course, is outraged and goes to wake up another sleeping lion. I mean, the lion is also asleep. And he says, "Wake up and defend yourself. I heard you malign my family." And the lion said, "I didn't say anything about your family." And the elephant is persistent and insists on a fight. And of course, the lion trounces the elephant. The elephant at this point realizes that he has been tricked linguistically by the monkey, and he goes back to try to kill the monkey. And almost never in the tales, once in a while, the elephant will catch the monkey, but almost always, the monkey will laugh at the elephant's folly. Mm-hmm. Now, what do these tales tell us? I mean, obviously, they're allegories.
Yeah, how did they form the basis for a literary theory? That's what we want to get at.
Well, they're obviously allegories, political allegories, certainly, for in the same way that Brer Rabbit was, for outwitting superior physical forces through wit, through linguistic dexterity, okay? But even more important for a literary critic and for a cultural critic, they are allegories for rules of interpretation. And what do I mean by that? The elephant seems to be doomed forever to misunderstand the figurative for the literal. The monkey is always lying. The monkey is always using language figuratively. The elephant insists upon reading the monkey's discourse literally, and therefore he is duped. And therefore, he is doomed for perpetuity to be trounced by the lion. That is the allegory That is the allegorical message of those tales. And that's brilliant. I mean, you think that these are tales that come from slavery. Uh-huh. These are tales that slaves made up, and that the tale was generated to show that things are not what they often appear to be. What I became interested in is the way in which black writers read and revise and thereby critique other black writers. Hmm. You see, when... let's say Frederick Douglass sat down to write his slave narrative, which was published in 1845. He clearly read the 1789 slave narrative of a slave called Equiano, who wrote a very mm-hmm. popular, very brilliant slave narrative published in London in 1789. Mm-hmm. What's that relationship between those texts? So you see, I was looking for an indigenously black metaphor for this kind of literary critique and revision.
The way black people wrote and talked about themselves.
Right, and uh-huh. the way that a black author would respond to a previous black author. Mm-hmm. And so I call that relationship signifying, because one of the aspects of the linguistic ritual signifying is that you repeat what someone supposedly said, but you repeat it with a difference. That form of repetition with a difference mm-hmm. is fundamental to signifying. And that is what, say, Alice Walker does to Zora Neale Hurston uh-huh. In The Color Purple when she is rewriting Their Eyes Are Watching God. It's not that black writers only reread and revise other black writers. It's, in fact, that's just not the case. And, Toni Morrison, for instance, clearly was influenced by Faulkner, by Marquez, and by Virginia Woolf.
In Beloved.
In Beloved, that's uh-huh. right. But it's also clear that black writers do read and revise other black writers. And since many other scholars had written about the patterns of literary revision between black writers and white writers, mm-hmm. I decided to write about the pattern of revisions between black writers, all the while saying, of course, this doesn't account for the whole picture. And right. that I call the signifying literary relationship.
You are telling me, Skip Gates, about what amounts to a tradition when you say that black writers rethink, revise one another. You're telling me that the basis for this literary theory is continuity. The charge has been that in black letters there is no continuity, there is no tradition.
Right.
It simply exists marginally outside of what do you call it, white literature? Tell me about that.
Well, that's certainly been the charge, and it's certainly a charge based on ignorance.
Is it ignorance or is it racism? What tell me, I'm misleading you, taking you off the track here a little bit. What about that?
Well, the most generous interpretation one can place upon it is to say it's ignorance. The least generous is to say it's racist.
Okay.
So we have a range of possibility there. I choose ignorance. I think the fact that black writers were isolated, ghettoized, segregated from the larger American tradition in the first place made it inescapable mm-hmm. that they would turn to each other as literary models. But also, when one seeks to represent an experience, one turns to models of representation of that experience to pattern one's own writing after.
Sure.
Those patterns of revision, that pattern of turning to another black writer to see how one's black experience had been rendered, is what creates a tradition. You see, tradition, our notions of tradition were largely produced in the 19th century at a time of great nation formation. They are fundamentally nationalistic. They're based more on mythology than they are on anything actual, on any actual set of literary relationships.
Not to mention the commercial impulses that undergirded this whole enterprise then.
That's right. And so that the sub-tradition of nationalism, as it were, which would be produced within an ethnic group that was not part of the larger society, that is, African Americans or today Asian Americans or Native Americans.
Right.
This sort of literary nationalism has been largely overlooked. And it's our generation of scholars who have the pleasure and the task of defining those patterns of literary relationships. Again, I want to stress that it's not to say that an Asian American writer would not be influenced by an Anglo-American writer. Mm-hmm. It's just that we have not had a body of scholarship that discussed the Asian American or the African American tradition in terms of itself. And mm-hmm. that's inherently fascinating.
All right, Skip Gates, your book is The Signifying Monkey. Let me present you with an assumption, and you can criticize that, and we'll see where the assumption takes us. We assume that we want to live in a colorblind society, that equality is the kind of thing that will lead us to color blindness. If that's the case, what happens to the special characteristics of black black expressive culture. How, in effect, does black culture retain its identity, its visibility, its strength, and yet become part of a mainstream? Have I created a tension that doesn't necessarily have to exist?
No, I think it's a real tension. I think that those of us who teach ethnic studies have to be alarmed at the rise of the fascistic tendencies of ethnic nationalism that we see in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. As soon as that communist boot was lifted off, all these ethnic tensions, which we thought were gone, emerged in the most pernicious and nasty ways.
Absolutely.
And nobody wants to live in a world like that. I think that those of us in African American studies, specifically in ethnic American studies generally in the academy today, want to see these traditions, which have been invisible, which have been long denied, defined at last, have them voiced, have them realize their voice within their voices within the American academy, but not at the expense of somebody else's tradition.
So you're not pleading for privilege necessarily.
No, we're pleading for equality.
Okay.
And you see, the idea that we had all been part of one large American culture as expressed in literature through one large literary canon.
That's the myth.
Was a myth. It was just right. Not true.
Uh-huh.
That notion of the canon bracketed so many other voices and so many other faces, as it were. And our generation of scholar is saying, that was a myth. We are critiquing that myth and saying, okay, let's produce an American canon of literature, but let's have it multicolored.
All right. Now, we've been talking about the visible, the invisible, black expressive culture, Skip Gates. Recently, we've had a marvelous parade of headlines about a group called Two Live Crew. You wrote an editorial for the New York Times, and you defended the crew, and you did so in terms of coded language. I bet you took a lot of heat about that defense. Explain it to me. I mean, after all, here you are, a distinguished, respected professor in the American Academy, and you're standing up in front of young and tender minds, and these parents are looking at you and saying, you're defending what on the basis of what? Explain this to me, will you?
Well, unlike many people, I've listened to the Two Live Crew album, which, curiously enough, you can't listen to on the public airways because it's so lewd and risque.
Uh-huh.
So much of what they're up to is obviously sexist, flagrantly sexist and misogynistic. So much of what they're up to is obviously parodic. It's obviously a parody of forms, parody of certain received structures.
What do we have to do? Make a choice between the parody and the lewdness?
We have to do two things. We recognize it's blatant sexism and it's misogyny.
And you condemn that.
And I condemn it and insist on the necessity of feminist critique of misogyny and mm-hmm. sexism. Simultaneously, as a literary critic, as a person who studies language, I seek to understand and explain what they are doing with language. Uh-huh. And what they're doing is fascinating. So not on all of their cuts, but on many of the cuts, they parody form, as in one of the songs, which is a parody of the blues, and basically it says, it takes the standard form of the blues and turns it on its head. It says, my baby left me and I'm so happy. And today, I've never been happier in my whole life, and today I broke up my neighbor's happy home. You know, it's that kind of parody is very sophisticated, very, very funny and intriguing. It's taking a sacred form, as it were, within the black tradition and exploiting it,
let me stop you, Skip Gates. There are a lot of people in this country who don't enjoy the benefit of a sophisticated literary background such as yours, who are going to say to their kids, oh, let's be patient with what's going on here, and let me explain to you about all this parody. What these critics will hear rather more quickly is the so-called obscenity and the lewdness. You still going to defend it?
Oh, yes. I think that the premise of that kind of response is that black men, particularly, are animal-like, unthinking, and that they are the equivalent of dry tinder.
Uh-huh. About to explode,
waiting for some idle spark. Uh-huh. That there is a connection between rap and rape, and that this is a racist premise. And I think that that's what the real issue is. The issue is black men who are threatening in this society, who are talking dirty to white audiences.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I think we have seen such a heated response to Two Live Crew and have not seen an equivalent response to someone such as Andrew Dice Clay. Uh-huh. It goes back to old racist stereotypes.
There was a great response to his stuff, although you did not have this incendiary element of race involved.
He was not put in jail. Uh-huh. His album was not taken off the stand. I mean, we have to ask ourselves.
That tells us a lot.
It tells us absolutely. And ironically, many of us used to worry that the children of the black upper middle class who now live in Scarsdale and Tarrytown and right. Chapel Hill and places like that would be deprived of access to the black vernacular tradition. Ironically, however, rap is encoding the black vernacular tradition and making it available on record and tape, not only for upper middle class black kids and everybody else in the black community, right. but the larger American society as a whole. It's as if the black vernacular has never had more exposure than it is enjoying today.
So you see this as a good thing?
Oh, not only do I see it as a good thing, as the editor of the general editor of the Norton Anthology of African American Literature, I'm pleased to be able to say that we are including cassette tape with our anthology.
Not Two Live Crew.
On which the on which the vernacular will be recorded, mm-hmm. And of course printed in the anthology, and that there will be rap music. There, Robert O'Mealy, professor of English at Barnard, is the editor, and his selections will be final. And I don't know if he's including Two Live Crew or not. I have a feeling that he's not.
Henry Louis Gates, Jr. teaches at Duke University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Henry Louis Gates, Jr. is the author of The Signifying Monkey, a theory of African-American literary criticism, available from Oxford University Press. Soundings for Black History Month 1991 concludes now. My guest on the following portion of the program is another distinguished scholar of African-American letters. Arnold Rampersad teaches at Princeton University. His biography of Langston Hughes, a leading figure in the Harlem Renaissance, is available from Oxford University Press. Arnold Rampersad, welcome to the National Humanities Center in Soundings. Langston Hughes, you spent a long time writing a book about this man. Why do we remember him in the 1990s?
Well, I hope we still remember him in the 1990s, and we remember him, I think, from different points of view for different reasons. I think if you are an African American, you remember him because a long time ago, starting in the 1920s, but then continuing on through the succeeding decades, he devoted his life to poetry, to plays, to the writing of fiction. And not only did he do that, but that he made his principal subject, it's not his only subject, but his principal subject, the lives, the character, the history, the fortunes of black Americans. And he did so in a way that elevated, I think, our understanding of African American culture, made African Americans see themselves in ways they had not seen themselves quite before. Uh-huh. And
did he think of this as a battle, or was this a sort of an individual artistic journey that he had undertaken?
I don't think he saw it as a battle, in the sense that that he was on the defensive from the beginning. I think he faced life with a great deal of optimism and mm-hmm. joy. On the other hand, he did go into places where it was very clear to him that he was lucky. He was going to be lucky to come out alive, as it were, literal places and also metaphorical places. I think he did see his life in some sense as an epic journey. But I think the joy, the sense of joy and of idealism that he brought to life, these things made the entire enterprise for him less of a struggle than of an affirmation, mm-hmm. I would say.
How do you account for his creativity? I realize that's a kind of a wide-eyed question, but do you look at it in terms of his education? Do you look at it in terms of his family background? Do we simply say that the man was a genius and let it go at that? What kind of mixture, as it were, produced Langston Hughes?
Well, I think he was born with a certain disposition toward language. I presume that he was born with such a disposition on which he could subsequently build. I think when he was a very small child, he clearly was taught by his grandmother, his mother's mother, that that he had a strong obligation to society, and in particular to African Americans, to do something with his life.
Now, one of his collections is called The Negro Mother, is it not?
Yes, it is called The Negro Mother, and he... And he, as I said, identified his art with the race, in response, as it were, to his grandmother's injunction to him to be loyal to the race. But I think, in her case, loyal to the ideals of social justice more than just the race.
How would you characterize the line between you and Langston Hughes? Here, you are this man's biographer. Were you writing his life? Were you writing about his work? How do you figure out the mixture between the two?
Well, I think you have to recognize as a biographer that biography is in part fiction, also that there is a subjective leakage, as it were, from the biographer to the subject, particularly if the subject, say, is a romantic poet, as Hughes was for a good part of his life. There is going to be that, and I try to keep a distance between myself and Langston Hughes as much as possible. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you do need to empathize in some way with your subject and to allow him to come to you, as it were.
Do you like this man?
Oh, yes. I would say that biography, done right, is probably going to be a long haul, and it's essential that you like the person. I wasn't very far into Hughes's papers, the voluminous papers at Yale University and elsewhere, before I understood, looking at his private correspondence, that he was a man of great generosity and principle and, and courage and just likable, as indeed people loved him in his own lifetime.
What was the toughest challenge that you encountered, Arnold Rampersad, writing about Langston Hughes? Figuring out particular facts, figuring out particular interpretations. Where was the rub there?
Well, I think interpretation would always provide the greater challenge. On the other hand, digging up facts, that can be a great problem, too. In the case of Langston Hughes, I don't think it was as important as coming to at some understanding of the inner life. Mm-hmm. For this reason, that Hughes is such a warm-hearted, generous, and loving person that... people presumed, I think, a certain amount of, pardon the expression, superficiality in the man.
Well, now, you've characterized him mainly in glowing sort of positive terms. I don't mean to turn this into a gossip session, Arnold Rampersad, but did you find out things about this man that disturbed you, that you pondered over and said, well, maybe I ought not to put this in the book, or, you know, that kind of a decision?
Well, I was determined from the start not to leave anything out of the book because it might or might not reflect on Langston Hughes or affect his reputation. I mean, as long as it was relevant, I would include it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would have to say that as far as I was concerned, the more damaging, in a way, the better, because, I mean, there was a side of me that wanted to write a gripping, interesting book. Mm-hmm. No, I should backtrack and say not the more damaging, the better. But but the truth, I was determined to tell, if we define the truth by by facticity, as it were.
Uh-huh. Let's talk for a couple of minutes, Arnold Rampersad, about the teaching of black literature. This is a time of great transition in the American Academy. The entry into the curriculum, the blossoming, let's put it that way, of black letters. Tell me about the perils and rewards of reshaping our cultural inheritance, particularly with attention to people like Langston Hughes.
The perils and the rewards. Well, the perils are there. One peril is that people coming to this reshaping of the canon with radical partisan interest, that these people are going to come out on the one side you don't want people to come out on, which is to have a lessened respect for reading, a lessened respect for the multiplicity of cultural meaning and achievement, that people will read fewer books. That's always a danger. But I think the glories are far outweigh the risks, and the glories are that we are getting more and more of a literary canon that that reflects the full variety of human experience. And and I myself, while I do not wish to abandon a single text of those that that I was forced to read. Mm-hmm. I look forward very much to reading new texts by people who had been left out of the canon, and introducing students to these books and these authors.
You think that this enterprise that you're engaged in, Arnold Rappersad, is going to do anything about the sort of hard practical problems that we face in social rather than strictly literary terms? Racism in America. Do you think it the teaching that you do, the kind of writing that you do, do you think it moves us in the right direction down the road?
Well, for a long time, it was assumed that racism and other social ills, certain other social ills, that racism was based on ignorance as much as anything else, and based on an absence of a discussion of certain issues involving race and power and politics and so on. And I think that the inclusion of books by black authors, to give only one example, in the curriculum, can only improve the situation, can only improve the climate. It may change things in a way that make us all feel uncomfortable, but I think in the long run it does represent an improvement.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing a TV feature recently about racism on American campuses, and one of the professors stood up and said, "How many of you students want to live in a colorblind society?" And not practically, everybody in the class moved over to that side of the room. Now, how is it that we can live in a colorblind society and yet, somehow enshrine or cherish or use or draw upon our black literary inheritance and set it up as something special? Is there a contradiction there?
Well, yes and no. I think at some literal level there may be a contradiction, but in effect, what we have seen again and again historically and up to the present day is that colorblind usually means white.
Uh-huh.
And that if you want a genuine colorblind society, I think such a thing really is impossible. What you want is a society in which people are not at a disadvantage because of their color. And it's one is much more likely to be assured of that kind of justice if all opinions are given expression and all literatures, for example, are read, than if, in fact, we all take refuge behind some notion of colorblindness that, in effect, is one culture's imposition of its values,
uh-huh.
and our acceptance of one culture's values as being universal.
Arnold Rampersad teaches at Princeton University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Arnold Rampersad's biography of Langston Hughes was published by Oxford University Press. Soundings for Black History Month 1991 is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding discussion, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 543. That's program number 543. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. All four editions of Soundings for Black History Month 1991 are available for $10. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with Andrew DelBanco, a professor of English at Columbia University. Our topic will be Andrew DelBanco's study of representations of evil in American culture. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Ford Foundation. Additional support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.